How can the sanctuary idea and the picture of a sanctuary be helpful in our search for God? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host. My conversation partners are Dave Thomas and Paul Dibdahl. Let's address that question. In a modern world where people are not particularly attuned to religion, what in the world does sanctuary do in terms of making contact with them?
I was interested when you used the word sanctuary, Alden, because I wonder how many people are aware or how many are not aware of what we mean in the Old Testament by the sanctuary. Certainly it was a building that was that had great religious significance. It was the center of religious life, the precursor to the temple, which I think is a very different meaning than what we run into when people hear the word sanctuary today. They're thinking of more of a safe place, a quiet place perhaps, a place where you feel secure.
So the Bible, especially certain books, and certainly in the Old Testament, says a lot about sanctuary. How do we translate that then into an idiom for modern people for whom the words don't mean anything?
I think in the world today, at least in North American culture, when people think of God, at least for many people, we have a very kind of almost buddy-buddy sense with God, that God is our friend. God is someone that you could spend time with, walking here, walking there. I think in the ancient world, not just in Israelite culture of the Old Testament, but just in general, there was much more of a sense of necessary space between human beings and God or the gods. And the sanctuary provides a kind of a place where there can be some kind of connection, which is established between a high and awesome God and the creation and human beings. And I think, I mean, we'll continue to explore this, I suppose, throughout our time together. But that it certainly served that important function of a place where divine and human can connect. That was, I think, central, at least originally.
Yeah, I like the way you put that, Paul, because my own sense is that in ancient times and even in some places today, the supernatural world is viewed as being dangerous and even malevolent. You know, that you have to use magic and divination and all kinds of other techniques in order to keep the supernatural world away from you. And I like your description here that the sanctuary actually is a place where people can come with confidence and humility and encounter the deity in ways that were not so scary.
Yeah.
I think it was C.S. Lewis that pointed out that it's interesting that when an angel appears to people in the Bible, their response almost is, "Fear not," because it was so scary.
People are afraid, yeah.
And he contrasts that with the cuddly little angels that we have today that are supposed to be all kind of nice and sweet. But the biblical picture is, "Fear not," because it's a really scary thing. Now, another question that I have, and this one is, I don't know it has a good answer, but when you start to think of sanctuary, and the Bible talks about a heavenly sanctuary, where is God? Is he up?
You mean like geographically, location, asking?
I think most of us, if we are praying people, tend to think geographically, don't we?
Well, everybody knows heaven is up, Holden.
Okay.
God is everywhere.
God is everywhere.
Including up.
Including up.
Yes.
Okay. Well, part of that is a challenge that we have in dealing with the difference between concrete thinking and abstract thinking people, and we'll have a chance to address that. But the more sophisticated you get, the more difficult it is to take those concrete images seriously.
Yeah, when the planet was no longer flat, up became a bit of a problem. But I think, you know, I want to be careful with what Paul said, though, because when you say God is everywhere, I think the presence of God is everywhere. That's different than saying that God is in everything.
You're worried about pantheism? Is that what you're
concerned
about?
God and his universe are not intertwined. They have separate existences, separate sense of being.
Well, one of the beauties of that complex doctrine, the Trinity, is that it seeks to preserve those things that are important. There's always someone on the throne, God became human flesh and dwelt among us, but through the Spirit, God is everywhere present. Now, I can't understand that, and I'm not sure that there is anybody who can, but it tends to preserve those different important things. Now, there's a biblical passage that's cited in the official study guide that I'd like to address because it raises another question. It is in Scripture, the sanctuary is kind of the control room for God's government. And in the setting of that temple, Psalm 11, 4-7 brings together the two opposing sides in the great struggle between good and evil. The condemnation of the wicked is stated in no uncertain terms. Quotes, "The wicked, those who love violence, he hates with a passion." Now, if God hates the wicked with a passion, how does God and how do his followers mediate a message of grace to the wicked without taking the catastrophic results of sin too lightly? How does that happen? That psalm sounds pretty catastrophic if you're on the wrong side of the fence.
Well, maybe it's supposed to. You know, Alden, if you went to the doctor with a deadly disease and he said, well, you know, you do have an illness, but I think, you know, it's okay, we still love you and you'll be okay eventually, I don't think you would do much to change your circumstance, especially if it was related to the way you were living somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, you know, I've known of some people who have come to faith precisely because of the dynamic here, that they realize that God makes no accommodation for evil, and when they saw themselves as caught up in evil, it became an instrument of their repentance. So,
So there's a danger, and Paul mentioned right at the beginning that the tendency of our world today is to make God a very friendly sort of a chap that we can go for walks with. There's a real danger there in tempting us to overlook the disease that we really need to address.
Yeah, and I mean, the Bible uses this phrase, the fear of the Lord, and mm-hmm. it's not the abject fear that you sometimes see, like when somebody holds a gun on you. It's mm-hmm. not a paralyzing fear when you get a big fright. I think it's a profound regard. The fear of God is a recognition that he is great and mighty, and we are fairly puny.
Yeah.
And that, God is not going to accommodate evil, and therefore, if we choose to embroil ourselves in it or catch ourselves up in it, we have an appointment with a holy God that will not go well.
Yeah.
Paul,
you've taken, and it is, this is a sort of a, how shall I describe this passage? I mean, it hits hard, this passage. But I think remembering, you know, taking the book of Psalms as a whole, understanding a little bit of the background, these are prayers that people have prayed. You have the whole gamut of emotions expressed. And I think to see this as sort of the tone of the scriptures as a whole would be quite a mistake. But it expresses something about the seriousness of wickedness and sin. What would we want? Would we want to worship a God that loved? Just shrugged it at violence and wickedness and that which destroys people. I think God mm-hmm. ought to hate those kinds of things.
But I think also we have to be careful when we read this sentence. He hates with a passion. You know, the anger and the wrath of God are not like ours. You know, we get mad and destroy things. I think that God's anger, his wrath, his hatred is not a fit of ill temper. It does not represent the loss of control of self-governance. I think it's a far more deliberate thing where God is going to make no deals with evil, period. Mm-hmm. And so I think we should be careful not to see this as God suddenly got mad and fried somebody.
Well, one of the things that intrigues me, and I've mentioned this over and over again, is the way Jesus got angry. You know, when he cleansed the temple, first of all, he attacked the furniture, not the people. But then the second point is that the evil people fled and the children came running. See, I think that is just absolutely amazing. I would give anything to be able to be angry like that.
Yeah, that is fascinating. The people who were convicted by their own misdoings and they fled, but the children who were innocent saw this as no problem.
One more question here before our time runs out, and that is the sanctuary imagery in the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation does a lot with sanctuary. God is all-powerful. But the thing that intrigues me in the book of Revelation is that when you restore the new earth, John says, I saw no temple there. And I was wondering if this suggests that the fear of God represented, encouraged, and developed by a sanctuary model, when we are restored, the fact that there is no temple, that God himself is the temple, does that represent a restoration when the old rules no longer apply?
Well, I was kind of tracking until that last sentence, the old rules no longer apply. I'm not sure.
The old rules, when there are sinners, see, we'll be in a restored world where sin is no longer an issue.
Yeah, and I think at that time, this sense of separation, this sense of otherness, that will be overcome, and we will be one, and God will walk with us, and we will see his face, all of those kinds of things. So the need for veils and courtyards and separations and all of that, we won't need those anymore. It will be different.
Mm-hmm. See, this is a return to the way things were before Genesis 3.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's amazing to read in the early parts of Genesis that God came down in the cool of the day and he communed in person with Adam and Eve. The sin destroyed that capacity, that possibility. And so I think that what you're alluding to here is not a bad thought at all, is that when the problem of sin is resolved, then the separation, you no longer need this edifice that allows for the approach of God and humans.
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk more about the development of the human fear, because when you go back to Genesis, Dave, it's quite clear that when after the sin, when God came walking in the garden, he didn't go in there angry, where are you guys? No, he was just going for a walk, and I think that's a crucial thing. Next week, we will continue our series. Our topic will be Heaven on Earth. My conversation partners will again be Dave Thomas and Paul Dibdahl. Want to thank all of you for listening in, and my thanks to Chad Ofterhauer, our program engineer. For the Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.